Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Carey, whose latest novel is His Illegal Self. Earlier novels include Theft, My Life is a Fake, Oscar and Lucinda, The True History of the Kelly Gang, Jack Mag, several others. Recently, a nonfiction, in quotes, book, Wrong About Japan, which I want to talk to you about. Let's start with your most recent book. According to what I read on your website and in other material, the story of His Illegal Self began with an image, and the image came from the writer Patrick McGraw, who's an expatriate, also living in New York, and it was the image of a woman on an airstrip. Take it from there.
Patrick is the only writer on earth with whom I discussed these sort of things, like, how's the book doing, what are you doing, and Patrick said, you know, was in Belize, his image. He said, I've just got this woman, and she's standing on this airstrip, and it's very early in the morning, so it gives me all of the atmospherics. And I said, oh, wow. So what happens next? He said, I've got no idea. And I thought, how cool is that? When I started to think about this book, I was thinking about something else. I was thinking about things in my own past. I was thinking about an American guy I knew who was on the run for various reasons from the FBI and ended up in Australia. But I also, when I started to think about where I would start it, and I thought, well, and I had this image, different to Patrick's, but not dissimilar in a certain respect, in which I'm imagining Queensland, just north of Brisbane. I'm imagining there's a big tropical storm coming, as they do. The sky is sort of thunder black, and there's this steady stream of cars fleeing the storm with their headlights on in the middle of the day. And on the other side of the road, I imagine this hippie mother and a little boy hitching the other way. That is where I began to write the story. That's the scene I went into. And I knew some things that were going to happen. I was a bit further ahead than Patrick, but which was that, you know, they were going to be picked up by some hippies, they were going to end up living in a particular place, some things were going to happen. But anyway, as usual, you get into a book and it's all very exciting and new and fabulous and you're so clever. But after a little bit, you know, I start to get into trouble and things were hard. And I said to Patrick, God, I'm going crazy. I said, what happened with your thing with the woman on the airstrip in Belize? He said, I got rid of that ages ago. So I didn't get rid of mine. It just ends up not being the first scene in the book. But it was a useful way to get into the story.
Did that happen after you'd finished Theft?
Oh, yeah. Richard, when I finish a book normally, I'm so emptied of everything, I often have no idea at all. But I did recall this American guy who was on the run, who came to live with us hippies. And the thing that connected it with Theft was I'd so enjoyed writing Theft, a love story which is set in a place where I'd lived in Australia. And I had no idea that I could recall it so well. I mean, it's a long time since I lived on the place by the Never Never River, it was called, in the Promised Land, really. And I lived on this beautiful river. And when I started to write Theft and decided to use that place, I was really quite shocked by how much I could remember. And it was fun. You know, I live in New York City. You know, I'm on Broadway, you know, down near Canal Street. In my head, I've got all this stuff. So I thought it would be great to write about subtropical Queensland in the 70s. It would just be a good place for my head to live for a couple of years.
You'd lived on a commune there. Had you ever thought in the past about using that material in a book?
I sort of used it. My first published novel was written when I was actually living in that place, and I then set it, some of it, in a place like that. And that book was called Bliss. Quite a different sort of a book. The sort of book that I wrote it in a year. I keep on thinking, how do you write a book in a year? I don't know how to do that anymore. I was cleverer then. But I certainly incorporated things from the world around me in that book.
At what point did you realize that you were going to start in America and it was going to be the story of a woman with connections in the radical underground during the Vietnam War era running away with a radical son?
Yeah. I have to tell you the real life seed of the story, the thing that I didn't want to write about but made me think about it. One of the great things about living in that community, no one ever said, what do you do? So people generally accepted people. It was a very nice place.
At that point, you were also a part-time ad writer.
Well, we can get into that in a minute, too. Yes, well, that's true. Just as well they didn't ask what I did, because by the time they found out, they were my friends, so it was all cool. But they would have been rather suspicious of me. But many of us had secrets, not least the American guy I was telling you about. So he arrived in the community, and we were pleased to see him because he bought a derelict place and started to fix it up. A moment came when I realized that he had no idea where on earth he was. He thought he'd come to the end of the earth because he began to plant marijuana plants in his driveway. Yeah, we were in wilderness. The Queensland police were forever there. It would be the most stupid thing on earth to do. So we said, for God's sake, do not do that. And he said, all right. Anyway, he lived there. And then one morning, about a year later or whatever, there were these helicopter raids and police everywhere. And we discovered that our friend was wanted for conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States from Mexico. And various actually quite funny things and terrible things happened as a result. But the thing that stayed in my mind was that he didn't know where he was, and he was on the run, and he'd come to this place, and he thought he'd fallen off the edge of the earth, but he hadn't. And I always thought about that. There were, as I said, lots of comic things about it too. So I didn't want to write about someone who had done what he'd done. But I wanted to think about, well, what was the other reason some people from this country might be in that country on the run? Well, Vietnam, the anti-war movement, which is something that I did know something about, and I began to invent the story. But when I began to invent it and I saw this woman and this child, I really didn't know all the things at all that had happened to them. I didn't really know their real relationship. One of the lovely things about writing and going on and on is finding these things out and saying, well, if that's the case, then that must be the case, and you making it up as you go.
So at one point you became aware this wasn't his mother.
Yeah. The first image I had when I first thought about them, and it serves, you're allowed a certain amount of sloppy thinking at this stage, muddy sort of thinking. I was thinking of those sort of hippie mothers and those little boys you'd see on those roads going between a commune and a festival or something, and the little boys were always so fiercely protective of their mothers, and they'd walk for miles and miles and miles. So that's what I thought. And I thought some more, of course, and then I changed my mind.
Well, at that point, are you kind of going for long walks? Are you sitting at your computer when you're doing that?
Long walks, my mind tends to wander a little more than my feet, I think. I tend to talk to myself on the computer. Really, I'd like talking out loud, saying, if this is this and if she does that, and actually write these words down, then that must mean that. And what if she was this, or what if he was that, like that.
And so at one point you write down, well, what if she isn't his mother?
Yeah.
And then what does that mean? Well, then he has to have a real mother and then a real father. Oh, if he's got a real father, what's her connection to the real father?
Yeah, all of those things.
And it kind of goes like that.
Yeah, and that's how it slowly, slowly gets built. And also when you start to, one of the things as I start to figure out the student radicals at Harvard were very different to the student radicals I knew in Australia. And having had friends who were there, American friends who were at Harvard at that time, you realize a certain amount of privilege. I mean, from the distance of Australia, you're not really thinking that these are really rich people and privileged people. So when I started to think about all of that, and so what the boy's real mother's class background was. And so therefore I would make Dial, the person who's what we think is the mother, of a different class background. And from a very political background, which her father was a Greek communist, so then his politics are quite at variance with Harvard SDS. So these sort of things are built sort of abstractly almost, like a sort of an equation, before I find out who this little guy with the bullet wounds in his hands is.
Well, when you reach a certain point, obviously where the United States invaded Iraq and there's the Iraq War and people compare it to Vietnam, is it tempting to play the allegory or metaphor game, or do you kind of just put that out of your mind?
You know, the weird thing is, it wasn't in my head for a second. But the other sort of the thing, of course, is that readers do that for you all the time. You don't need to do that. And, of course, everybody is reading it, you know, with those things in mind, because that's life now, and it makes sense, and it does shine on now. But it isn't what I set out to do.
Peter Carey, in an interview for the book Theft, someone asked you about this book you were working on, and you said that it's it's the memories of a 30-ish person when he was younger. A little bit of that remains, but not much.
Oh, you're so right. You should never, ever, ever talk about things that you're going to write or when you're writing them, because when I set off to write it, I was going to do it totally in the kid's perspective, and in order to have some sort of distance and some sort of sense of umbrella view of, or more godlike view. I thought, well, this is the kid as he is remembered by the man he becomes, and the man he becomes is inhabiting the kid's point of view. And that's how I tried to write it. That in itself is a little bit of a challenge. As you say, there are scraps of it behind, and I think there are two or three or four, not a lot. I think they work, and I think they're sort of quite important in the structure of the book, and that it makes you understand the kid has a future, that he has a life after this, that this has been, in effect, a chapter of his life. But I was writing it, and if I might say so myself, I think it was quite beautifully written, but it was really dull. And I thought, why is it dull? And sometimes you get into these things, you know, where you're working away and you're working away, and you really don't know what's wrong with what you're doing. And then I sort of work out that I've really left out the woman's perspective, all her history, and all these things which I knew I'd sort of invented, because I had to have invented them for her actions. And the minute I changed that, and so then I really had two points of view going, and it all sort of came to life. But yes, I you're the second person that's thrown that back in my face, and I do deserve that, and I should never ever speak about the process.
I think the process is fascinating because we get a chance to see what it is like in certain stages, and I don't read that until after I read the book, and then I go, oh, wait a second. Did you go back to Queensland and check out the scene?
As you've read the book, you'll know there's a certain period when they go to the beach a lot. And the beaches along there were and are astonishing. Very beautiful. And even now, you can find totally deserted surf beaches there. So I went back with Frances, my partner, and she and I stayed on the beach, and it was really nice. And I said, yeah, I better go in there, have a look, you know. But the funny thing was that in going inland and going into this country, firstly, the country had changed. One of the most remarkable and very beautiful things about it was that it was a cane-growing area. So you've got this intense green. You drive between these tall canyons of cane, and which would be set on fire at night. And it was very spectacular. Of course, it's ecologically disastrous. It pours, you know, nitrogen into the water. It ruins everything. Anyway, by now, firstly, that's gone. And one of the distinctive things of the landscape's gone. That's good generally, ecologically, but it makes the place look different. And secondly, I realized, even going into the place where I lived, that really it's in my head, and it's in my head in a really, really vivid, vivid way. I don't need to go there. It doesn't help to go there. But it was a nice excuse. I had a lovely time at Noosa Heads on the beach and ate some fabulous food and was just a tourist.
When you're writing a book like this, and there are all different kinds of subtexts, and I'm not talking about the Vietnam Iraq subtext. I'm talking about subtexts of people hiding out, concealing themselves, determining what they're going to tell or who they're going to be. How much of that is conscious to Peter Carey when he's working on a novel like this?
Not very much. When you talk about how much you're going to tell, some of that you could almost, I think, is hugely important in the business of writing fiction. And we could even belittle it by calling it technical, which was worth saying, not because it is really, but because you understand that you decide not to tell this now. You'll tell that later, and you'll tell that later. And one of the joys of reading a novel is the joy of what you're about to find out and what you don't know. And so the artful withholding of information, I think, is terribly important. I've never had a book where I think I've so artfully withheld information, and I'm very, very happy about that. So I'd put that to one side, to what I take to be some sort of psychological subtext in the question. And the answer to that part of it is, I don't know. I mean, I just make up this stuff.
In a book, say, like, My Life is a Fake, you know, there's all kinds of subtext swirling around about the nature of art, the nature of writing, the nature of creation, and what happens if a fake poem is better than a real one.
Well, you see, that particular issue, My Life is a Fake, that exists in Australian history. You know, these guys really did make this fake poem. They were anti-modernists, they were conservatives. They invent this working-class poet to make fun of modernism. And the historical reality is that now they're dead and buried. No one really reads their poetry too much, but the guy they invented, Ern Malley, we read his poetry, and it will be in an anthologies of modern Australian verse. So this is really true. More than that, we sort of imagine because of the sort of hoax that they played with the letters they wrote and whatever, we could sort of imagine who Malley might have been. And being Australians, where we draw a sort of a class line that's really working class, you know, when we sort of think about ourselves, even if our society's not like that at all, we sort of like him, when we really like the notion of this person who was invented to hoax us. And when I thought about that particular story, I thought, well, he lives. They brought him to life. And having thought of that as something that had happened sort of metaphorically, if you like, I thought, hell, what if I made it real? Like he really did come to life. And when I began to write that book, I was thinking of writing it in the first-person narrative from the point of view of the poet who is born at the age of 24 in the backyard of a suburban and is in a rage because everyone's telling him he's a fake and blah, blah, blah. So that's where it started. People will read the book in different ways because, you know, some people will read and think, well, it's impossible he came to life. I have to confess, writing it, I really believe he came to life and that what was born from this particular unhealthy seed was a great poet. That's what the book's about. And also that the hoaxer ends up sort of being his guardian and his caretaker, and he's the person that will carry the treasure of the poetry forward, or attempt to anyway.
You're listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is His Illegal Self. The journey that Dial, and why did you name her Dial?
You know what? I know how I've justified it. Well, I've justified it because it's a nickname. She's been teased.
Right, yeah, I know that.
Because
yeah,
she's
yeah.
argued about the notion of dialectic. But really, in truth, that name just sort of came from somewhere. I have my own private reasons, which I'm not going to divulge to you, about why that name came from somewhere. It has a literary echo of a character's name, and I think that's why I just called her Dial. I didn't know it. And then later I sort of figure out, well, yeah, she's called this, and I have to figure out why she's called this. And then so that gets created backwards.
When you're creating the book and you start when they're already in Queensland, then you have to almost reverse engineer back to the original kidnapping or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I think one of the questions I'm always asking myself, no matter that, or is why would someone really do that? And often I would often begin by asking my characters to do ridiculous things simply because I want them to do that. And I just feel instinctively that that's the right thing. And then I spend years figuring out why any person in their right mind would. And then I have to build the person that would perform that action. And that's true. But in the biggest scale, and the question that you ask, yes, you know, at the time that I have her and the boy walking along the road, I don't know that she's of Greek descent. I don't know her father was in the resistance in Greece. I don't know that she's been to manage for a working class girl, very difficult to get to Radcliffe, to Harvard at that time. All these things come as part of the discovery of the book.
In a book like My Life is a Fake, at what point do you realize that this is a story that has to be told through multiple quotation marks?
Which I didn't use. Multiple frames of, yeah, storytelling,
yeah.
Russian doll storytelling, or whatever you want, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was incredibly lucky. It was sort of like I started to tell it in one voice, and then I realized that we needed the input from another character who had to provide more information. And then we needed the input from the next character had to provide more information, and they fell together. And I do remember thinking at the time, oh, this is like having a good run with the traffic lights. You know what I mean? And like everything just sort of fell, and it worked, and it sustained, the structure sustained itself. So maybe I've got old enough and smart enough so that I actually, at some level, knew what I was doing. And so, and it's a story within the story within this. And people say, well, wait, one of the reasons in that particular book you just cannot have inverted commas, because you would have so many sets of inverted commas that you would all be driven crazy.
Which is what John Barth once did in a short story in Lost in the Funhouse. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Well, years ago I read that, but I don't recall it.
Peter Carey, another book came out, a book that I fell absolutely in love with, called Wrong About Japan. The sense I got is that the reason the book was written was because you needed an excuse to take your son to Japan, and you figured, what the hell, I'll sell a book. Is that right?
It wasn't quite like that. It's similar. I'd signed a contract to write a book, a little travel book, which would involve me going into the Australian desert with an old friend who worked with Aboriginal people who had serious drug problems. as the time came along, and I thought, oh, I don't know that I even really, really, am I up for this? Do I really want to do this? At the same time, my son, who was then, I guess, about 10 or 11, became entranced by Japanese popular culture. And I'd sit and watch some of the things on television, which often were not terrifically good, but were visually extraordinary. And I'd start watching them with him. I watched a lot of crappy stuff with my kids on television. And we'd start to talk about it. And he said, he knew I'd been to Japan a couple of times. And he started to ask, maybe we can go to Japan one day. And I'd say, yeah, one day. And then the day came where I suddenly thought, my God, my agent can convert this Australian book into a Japanese book, and I'll go with him because we've got all these questions. And so I said, you know, what about if we do this? And so he was in heaven, and I was really, really happy. We had just a gorgeous time in the time before we left to do it, when we were there, and we went back twice. I'm really happy that you like it. But the thing that I think most about the book is I just think I was so blessed to have this time with my son. And just imagine you've got this 12-year-old kid, and I think he was 12. And you wake up on your first morning in Tokyo and manage to find a traditional inn with tatami matting on the floor. And it's jet lagged and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And he says, Dad, you awake? And you say, yes. He said, Dad, I'm really happy. It sounds like made up. Kids don't talk like that, but he did. It's like he met his heroes. We had a series of meetings with all these anime people.
You invented a character, Takashi, yet there's nothing in the American version of the book to indicate that anything is fictional. Why did you choose to invent that character?
Well, firstly, everywhere else it says that Takashi is made up. This is a sort of slightly dodgy area. The minute I found I didn't realize this had happened. So immediately when I went around talking about the book, the first thing I had to say to everybody was, Takashi is made up, because I really don't like the notion of deceiving your readers. I think your readers have got to trust where you're coming from. And the reason I felt I had to invent him was, well, I needed some, well, I'm a storyteller, I'm a novelist, I've got to have some sort of conflict, and I wasn't going to certainly provoke or invent it with our hosts, who were incredibly always courteous and kind, and of course in the end I think the book is hugely offensive to them, but that was not my intention, that's just because I'm a moron. Not only have I been unable to get a Japanese translator, or publisher, and I've had Japanese translators begging for the book, and then for 6 months to a year, and then having received it, go completely silent, and no one's able to tell me exactly quite how I was offensive. So Takashi was necessary to have some sort of conflict, I guess. And he provides, and my son's relationship with the imaginary friend sort of provides the story, I suppose. I also made myself much more sort of moronic than I really am. And so to have a father-son thing with Charlie. So, you know, people were in various reasons. I was being chided for forcing Charlie to do things, which, in fact, in real life, we were really at one at most things.
Well, I kind of figured something was up about Takashi early on when you kind of describe him as a superhero.
Oh, very nice. Well read. Yes. In the very beginning, so he's like an animated figure, right?
Yeah. And there's an animated figure there, and I'm going, wait a second, something is off here. I also noticed about three-quarters of the way through the book, every chance that he had to meet all of the people that you were going to interview, the real-life people, for one reason or another, he can't meet.
Yeah. That's a case where you have two things are going on, right? One is, of course, he was not at those meetings, and I didn't want to just... I mean, it is, the book's full of things, meetings that really occurred, and the things that occurred are as well reported as I know how to do it. So I can't put Takashi into the middle of that, because it introduces a dynamic that wasn't there, and that's one too many balls in the air anyway. But then, of course, what you then set up by not having someone who wants to be there and not be there is that you create an interesting character thing with him, and how he's going to respond to that, how Charlie is going to feel about him, and how other people are going to also feel about Takashi, and how Japanese people feel about kids that dress like that and look like that and so on.
You said before we went on the air that Charlie actually helped you work on the character. What did he do other than the name?
Particularly he named the character. I said, well, what are we going to call him? And he said, quick as a flash, Takashi, because he loved the actor beat Takashi, particularly one of those, it's called Kikajuru.
I've heard of it.
Which some people find a little bit saccharine, but I've seen it with my son probably 20 times, and I love it still. And so beat Takashi, this twitching Japanese hoodlum sort of character, that Takashi gave his name to this character. There were certain things he criticized. He said we should have been nicer to Takashi. And Charlie did go through on the very, and he didn't really want to do it, but he'd read it. But I said, I really want you to go through and make sure that I've got all the sort of names of the video games and the characters right, and you're really going to have to proofread this for me. And he said, well, when do you need it? And I said, well, by now I need it, really tomorrow. He said, all right, Dad. And he took it and gave it away with his pen, and he did it.
Peter Carey, putting aside the nonfiction work, many of your books deal with colonialism, either cultural or actual colonialism. And this is something that's been in your thoughts for a long time.
Yes, it has. Well, I think it's the condition of being Australian is to think about this. I mean, Australia didn't have a war of independence. It was possible, I think, in 1974 for the representative of the British Crown to dismiss the elected leader, Gough Whitlam, the leader of the Australian Labor Party. These things remain true to this day. If you want to think about the history of settlement in Australia, you know, there are two big things that happen. You know, one is you have a culture that's been there for 50,000 years, and there is, in effect, an invasion and a war, which we never really quite can bring ourselves to acknowledge, and the land is effectively stolen or conquered, whatever. And then you have these other people who, in any other country thing, would be the bad guys, in other words, the whiteys coming in to do this. But these people have been ripped, really, from their mother country, the poor, dispossessed, criminal, often, some political radicals, not a great many. And their trauma is huge. They're taken from their real place on earth and put in this godforsaken place which they hate and where they nearly starve, the soldiers too. So there is a big thing, I think, in the Australian thing of being cast out. There is a thing that deeply lies at the beginning of being second rate. People will say, well, this was a long time ago. Most of us are not descended from convicts. But, you know, it's like this country. You look at the effect of the Puritans and the Mayflower, and you see how those things, very few people are descended from those folks, but the values of the Puritans continue. The Mayflower is alive and well in certain threads of American society. Likewise with the thing. So the whole issue of having been a colony, having been cast out, having felt ourselves to be second rate, having been powerless, having wished to have strong protectors, whether it be Britain in the beginning or the United States at a certain stage and so on. These are all things that have to preoccupy us, I think. And when we think about who we are as individuals, these things become part of it.
One of the questions that comes up these days with regard to the United States is American exceptionalism, whether it be from the perspective of the right wing, which would say America, greatest country on earth, blah, 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 or even the left saying that America is the root of so many of the world's problems. Is America that central to the world outside of America?
I think it's very, very difficult to grasp when you are inside it. In other words, when you are American, and no matter how much you travel, and this has changed, and you know how well read you are, to quite grasp the enormous grip that America and American society has on the world's imagination, and to understand the degree to which even the enemies, the sworn enemies of the United States, probably have in their heart some Neil Diamond song that they fell in love with or two, and so on. And it's shocking for me. I'll be back in Australia at the end of this week. And I know I'm going to pick up the Australian newspapers and I'm going to see on the front page Paris Hilton and somebody in a mall in Arkansas who shot six people. So in other words, American things, the crap, assuming enormous importance on the front page of a national paper in a country on the other side of the world that has to do with nothing. And these little hints, you know, before we get into the war in Iraq and the destabilization of foreign governments and all of those sorts of things, no, the obsession is huge.
When you're in Australia, do you feel as if you're at the end of the world and America is at the central place? Like sometimes, say, I would feel in the East Bay just looking at San Francisco. Yeah. Even though, of course, I could drive there in 20 minutes, you know.
I think it's more complicated. I mean, the easy answer is to say, yes, it's like that. I don't really know how to answer the question simply or clearly, because there is the other part of it when you're there. Well, maybe it is exactly what you're saying. When you are Australian in Australia, you know, that really is the centre of your universe.
Sure.
And then around it, there's all these denied important things. And you are reading about Paris Hilton, and you are sending people to fight in Iraq because you're a great partner of the United States. And it is the sort of, you know, the flea on the dog. Because of the power of popular culture, and because we love so many things that come from this country, and they really are in our hearts, we have a false sense of familiarity and a false sense of our knowledge, which we don't have. And I do remember very, very clearly being in New York City and listening to some music that was probably from Tennessee, a place I've been, and where people in Chanel suits say our music, very interesting, and thinking, God, this is so weird, it is so foreign. And when I'm once in Australia, it would seem familiar. And when I finally was in this country, I understood the degree to which everything about that music was unrelated to anything really deep in my life at all. You know, where it had come from, what the history of it was, who made it, all those things.
Do you think that the more you see these sorts of contradictions, in a way, the easier it gets to write fiction that goes off into, you know, Russian dolls?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I began writing when I had no right to even pick up a pen, and I'd read nothing and knew nothing, but was filled with sort of... And I wanted to make something new and really beautiful and something that never existed before, and everything in me all my life really has been stretching to stretch myself to make something new. So I think that's quite a deep, deep drive. I mean, when I read Faulkner, William Faulkner, As I Lay Dying, and I realized that people could do this weird, beautiful, amazing stuff, it's all I wanted to do. That's what I've tried to do, and that's what drives me, I suppose.
One of your strengths is the different voices in your different books, and you've said that they come to you in a way that's almost magical.
I've only recently started to say that, because once upon a time I would have steered well away from using a word like magical about what I do. And I spent most of my life trying to make writing sound as ordinary as laying bricks, saying, we bake a brick every day and we lay it down, and that's all we do. You know? And I've suddenly, and partly it's because of, you know, watching the way people write about literature often and seeing how reductive it is and how much it sort of, you know, people imagine that it's not really made up, it's something that from the person's life that they're just reporting in a disguised way. And I suddenly realize it is magic. We are messing with magic. We go in and we do things. There's people in this book, I don't know. No, I can go back to a book that I've written before, and I don't even know really where it came from, and I don't even recognize it as anything to do with me. And so I do think it was Fellini who gave me the confidence to say this. I see Fellini there with his huge confidence saying, I am a magician. Well, I thought, well, actually, you are a damn magician, and we are magicians, and it is what we do, and it's quite important, I thought, to start saying it, because I think people have forgot that that's what we do.
One question I never asked you, but I have asked writers, because I wrote a couple of abortive novels, which never went anywhere, a couple of things that I finished that didn't sell, and I found this weird thing happening, and it almost happened in a synchronistic way, or in a mystical way, which is I'd write a scene in a book, and then 3 days later, the thing would happen to me,
yeah.
And I'd be going, what kind of planet am I on? Yeah. And I began asking people. Yeah. Each person, when I asked it, they'd interpret the question slightly differently, but they'd go, yeah, that happened to me too.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff ever happened to you?
Yes. Yes, it does. And I'm just trying to think, my memory's gone, but there's a short story, there's a part of a novel of Paul Auster's where the writer talks about having imagined this little girl drowning and then his own little girl. And there's a big element of this in my life as a fake, where the hoaxers imagine something, and what they imagine happens. And in my book Illywacker, the 139-year-old liar says things which are untrue when he says them, and they become true. Well, I think that's partly to do, generally speaking, the issue is the power of the imagination, which, after all, if you think of everything, in you know, the room we're sitting now, the city we're in, it didn't exist. People collectively imagined it and then built it. That's not so weird. And then there is just generally this sort of thing that you are messing with magic. And you better be careful what you imagine. Because you better take responsibility for what you imagine, because it might just happen.
Well, that's the thing that scared me. I'm going, well, wait a second. My character is getting darker and darker. Mm. I tried writing a novel about being here at KPFA, and all of that weird stuff began happening when I'd come into work.
There was a stage when I worked on a, not, I think the director himself would agree, not a hugely successful film. I worked with Wim Wenders on a film called Until the End of the World, in which for him, he wanted to imagine, you know, there'd been a nuclear explosion. And I remember our conversations about this, and I said, I don't think we should imagine this. I don't think it's good for us to imagine this. I think we should not imagine it. I can't remember where the film, probably there is some of this, I don't know. In The Tax Inspector, which is quite a dark book of mine, I worried immensely all the time that I was writing it. I mean, there's a young, disturbed adolescent boy who's contriving a rather sort of a cruel, sadistic sort of a rape. I'm imagining it anyway. I'm driven towards it by, for a very good reason, a very good moral reason, but all, as I'm writing it, I'm thinking, does the world really need to have this imagined? And at the same time I was writing it, Silence of the Lambs came out. I went to Silence of the Lambs, and I'm sorry, I was in a fury. I mean, I really didn't want that to exist in the world. And at the same time, I was passionately, of course, interrogating myself. I'm proud of the book now, by the way, but it's just to do with our responsibility for what we imagine.
Peter Carey, his illegal self, seems to be a prequel to another book. Mm-hmm. It feels that way, particularly the very, very end of the book, and it ends, he would carry along the littered path which would be his own comic and occasionally disastrous life. That makes me think, is there going to be another book about Che?
No, there's not. A book, there can be no the end. If there's an end to the book, it's the characters die, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a spiritual person, so I'm not worried about, but die, that's the end. But mostly, you know, very few novels end with everybody dying, right? In a sense, there's not an end to anything, because it's a chapter. It's a chapter of the characters' lives. It will go on. You will give it artistic form. It will be satisfying. I really, really, throughout the book, wanted to keep the reader aware that there would be a life after these events. And there was a very dear, very wise, gee, I think he's still alive, Australian guy called Jack Eagleton, who would say, at the worst moments of my life at certain times, he would say, this is just a chapter of your life. And it was very comforting, because it gave you some sort of odd, sort of, you know, rather sort of godlike perspective on yourself and your troubles. And I really wanted to do it for this book too, because there is an artistically, formally satisfying, emotionally satisfying, I hope intellectually satisfying ending, but it is absolutely not the end. And they will live on, I hope, in your imagination and in other readers' imagination, but I'm not going to write about that, and I'm not going to imagine it myself.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is His Illegal Self. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.